From KCRW in Santa Monica and PRI, Public Radio International, this is To the Point.
Drugs, violence, and Mexico's presidential campaign. Hello again, I'm Warren Olney, and this is To the Point from Public Radio International, a daily look at the issues Americans care about most. When Felipe Calderon was elected president 6 years ago, he declared a military offensive against Mexico's murderous drug cartels. 50,000 people have died. Calderon's term is over, and all three major candidates in the July election have pledged to reduce the violence. The question is how? Former President Vicente Fox has called for drug legalization, but none of the candidates has been specific so early in the three-month campaign. We'll hear about a nation of disillusioned voters and what the election results might mean for the United States. On Reporter's Notebook later on, distracting embarrassments for the Obama campaign. First, here's the news.
Support for To the Point comes from the members of KCRW and from the Public Radio International Program Fund.
Hello again, Warren Olney, back with To the Point. After a drug war that's killed some 50,000 people, Mexico is now beginning a three-month presidential campaign. Is there any way to reduce the violence? What about drug legalization? Will the election results have consequences for the United States? On Reporter's Notebook, the Secret Service with prostitutes in Colombia, federal bureaucrats partying in Las Vegas. What's the political fallout? First, this news update. George Zimmerman, the shooter in the Trayvon Martin killing, will be set free on $150,000 bond. Zimmerman spoke directly to Martin's family during the bail hearing this morning in Sanford, Florida.
I wanted to say I am sorry for the loss of your son. I did not know how old he was. I thought he was a little bit younger than I am, and I did not know if he was armed or not.
Judge Kenneth Lester said Zimmerman might not get out today, and the GPS monitoring will be required. He also ruled that Zimmerman might be allowed to leave Florida for his own safety. Trayvon Martin's family left the courthouse without speaking to reporters. Their attorney, Benjamin Crump, had this to say.
Tracy Martin had tears in his eyes as he watched the killer of his son. And it was devastating that he got to give a self-serving apology to help him get a bond. They were very outraged at that.
Jeff Weiner is covering the story. He's the courts reporter for the Orlando Sentinel. And, Jeff, good to have you back on our program.
Glad to be back. Thanks for having me.
Was it a surprise that under these circumstances, Zimmerman was allowed to testify?
It was very surprising. It's rare, and even his attorney, Mark O'Mara, said after the hearing that it's unusual for a murder defendant to take the stand, really, sometimes ever, but especially, you know, at something like a bond hearing. O'Mara said that it was Zimmerman's decision, that he had heard that Trayvon Martin's parents had been, you know, asking why he hadn't apologized, and that he wanted the opportunity to do so.
There was also testimony by investigators in the case, and that seemed to be unusual, too, in as much as the major witness said he didn't expect to testify at all, didn't bring his notes.
Well, normally when an investigator is called to testify at a hearing like this, he's called by the state and is told in advance. But he was, you know, the testimony that today was all people, you know, witnesses called by the defense. It is an unusual move. Speaking to other attorneys, they say that it represents, you know, a sign of confidence on the defense's part. They really attacked the state's case during the hearing today.
And how did the state respond?
Well, during cross-examination, the same investigator testified that there are aspects of George Zimmerman's story that are not consistent either with his other statements and with evidence in the case. We haven't seen that evidence and probably won't until the defense requests discovery. So there's still more facts to surface, but the state basically tried to suggest throughout the hearing that there's a lot more to come.
Does the confidence of the defense rest in part on the nature of the stand your own law, or is it independent of that?
It's difficult to say. They haven't been very willing to talk about the facts of the case or their approach to their defense. But obviously, we know that it's going to be a self-defense argument, and that the stand your ground law will play into that. During the testimony by the investigator today, he said that they don't, for example, know for sure who threw the first punch, you know, I think is how it was described, and essentially who initiated the actual physical confrontation. Something like that will certainly be an issue if this goes to trial and in you know, in future hearings as well.
And did the witness that represents the state, was the investigator but was called by the defense, did he indicate that he knew who threw the first punch?
No, he's the one who testified that they don't definitively know that. That was one of the biggest moments of the hearing, was just hearing that, you know, they have evidence of the lead up to the situation, that apparently that specific moment, there's no clear indication of what happened, or at least that's what was testified to today.
What about the possibility that Zimmerman will be allowed to leave the state? The judge seemed very concerned about his safety. Certainly the defense attorney was concerned about his safety. But there was some uncertainty about that issue and whether he could cross a state boundary.
Well, the situation's complicated by the fact that it's not the court system that administers GPS monitoring, which he was ordered onto GPS monitoring in Seminole County. It's the sheriff's office. So the judge, I think, was hesitant to agree to or decline aspects of that, just because he logistically it'll have to be worked out through the sheriff's office in Seminole County, and also whatever jurisdiction George Zimmerman wishes to relocate to, they'll have to be able to comply with the specifics of what the judge ordered today, which was GPS monitoring, check-ins with law enforcement, a curfew. You know, there were numerous stipulations placed on this bond, but it's really, really going to have to be the agency where Zimmerman goes that's monitoring him, not the local agency.
Judge Kenneth Lester appears to be a very experienced character and referred to this as a kind of a routine procedure.
Well, bond hearings are fairly routine. This one didn't play out in a routine manner, but he has been on the bench for 15 years. He's handled other high-profile cases, maybe not of this profile, but high-profile certainly locally. Very well-respected among the legal community here, and he treated it as a very, you know, he was very steady during the hearing today.
Well, thanks as always, Jeff Weiner, again, a courts reporter for the Orlando Sentinel. It's good to have you with us. In a moment, drugs, violence, and Mexico's presidential campaign on To The Point.
KCRW thanks Factiva from Dow Jones for its use of Factiva.com.
Warman Olney back with To The Point. Mexico's President Felipe Calderon is barred from seeking a second six-year term, and national politics could be in for another major shakeup. The leading candidate to replace him belongs to the PRI, which ran the country for 70 years. Calderon's party, the conservative PAN, is running the first woman candidate of a major party. The left-leaning PRD has nominated the former mayor of Mexico City, a one-time revolutionary who now talks about love. That's according to David Lunau, who's based in Mexico City for the Wall Street Journal. Good to have you on our program.
It's nice to be here.
So the PAN took the presidency 12 years ago when Vicente Fox was nominated, and there was much celebration because the PRI, who had governed the country for so long, was regarded as corrupt and in that respect, not serving the people. And yet the PRI now is leading the campaign.
That's right. It's the return of the PRI is the theme of this election. I think a lot of people in Mexico are a little disappointed in the 12 years of the PAN. And to a big extent, I think their disappointment stems from the fact that the PAN has largely failed to transform the country in the way that it promised. It hasn't really been able to get the economy going much better than the PRI did. It has helped promote economic stability, and that's helped create a bigger middle class. But basically, in a lot of the important ways in which Mexico falls short, its economy lacks competitiveness, for example, because it's dominated by big monopolies, in terms of corruption, in terms of violence. In some ways, some of these measures have gotten worse or just as bad as under the PRI. So I think the PRI is, after 12 years, able to present itself as an option for change. And now the PAN is trying to defend the status quo.
Should tell people the PRI is the Institutional Revolutionary Party. The PAN is the National Action Party. And the PRD, which we haven't talked about yet, the leftist party, is the Democratic Revolution Party. Now, if the PRI candidate is leading, what does that have to do with the fact that he's very young, very charismatic, and a lot of the voters are young, too?
That's right. That's a good point. And I think, you know, being a young, good-looking guy is helping him. One of the Mexican TV broadcasters certainly like him, and they give him fairly fawning coverage. That may be in part because he's married to an actual soap opera actress from one of the two big broadcasters. So that certainly doesn't help. That certainly doesn't hurt, rather. But I think the other two parties have largely hurt themselves. I think the PRI is really able to come back to power in Mexico because the PAN has been broadly ineffective in the last 12 years. And the PRD, as you mentioned, the leftist party, has a candidate that 6 years ago scared much of Mexico's middle class when he refused to recognize his very narrow defeat in a hotly contested election with President Calderon and took to the streets and protested and sort of called for the overthrow of Mexico's institutions. So I think he's sort of lagging in third place. The left is not really seen as a credible option yet. The conservative party is seen as inefficient. And the PRI sort of by default is sort of selling itself as, hey, we may be a little corrupt from the past, but we're effective and we can get some stuff done. And we've got enough new guys in there that we can sort of keep a lid on the corruption.
And the PRD candidate, the former mayor of Mexico City, is Andrés Manuel López Obrador. The candidate of the PAN is Josefina Vázquez Mota. Who's the candidate of the PRI?
The pre-candidate is Enrique Peña Nieto. As we've said, he's sort of a very good-looking young. He's 45, former governor of Mexico's biggest state, which is the state of Mexico, just south of Mexico City. He seemed to have done a fairly competent job as governor. They got a lot of infrastructure projects going, got the economy, goosed up the economy a little bit. Maybe not as good marks on public safety and in some other areas of his administration.
What about the war on drugs? 50,000 people killed in the past 5.5 years since the current president, Felipe Calderon, initiated that action. The others, I understand, have promised that they will try to quell the violence. But have they any specific way of doing it?
Well, that's a good question. You know, curiously, the drug war hasn't been the main or even a significant topic of conversation among the campaigns. Most of the proposals right now are centering on how to get Mexico's economy kind of moving again and how to get Mexico back into the global conversation of emerging markets. And I think part of the reason that that's the case is because there's somewhat of a consensus that President Calderon's overall attempt to attack the drug gangs was the right decision. But I think where the campaigns start to differ is in the strategy that Mr. Calderon used. Mr. Calderon very much went with the Army and Mexico's Navy and a newly created federal police force to sort of use force to go after the drug gangs, and in some cases may have made the violence worse. When you kill off the head of a drug gang, sometimes his younger, more ruthless gunmen fight each other to replace him, and therefore you get more violence rather than less. I think some of the campaigns, in particular the Peña Nieto campaign, has been focusing on a few different areas. Their pitch is that they want to try to focus a lot on the judicial reform. Mexico's judicial system has never really worked very well. So the Calderon administration has arrested a lot of young guys in the drugs trade, but they've all gotten out within days or weeks of their arrest because of a dysfunctional judicial system. So they want to try to focus a little bit more on strengthening the rule of law and sort of police investigations and the judicial side of things. And they also want to really boost economic growth and opportunities for young people. A lot of young Mexican men, for example, can't go to high school because there aren't enough high schools to actually take them in. So what Mexico does is they have these two shifts a day of four-hour high school days for kids. So you go in for 4 hours in the morning, and then a different set of kids comes in for 4 hours in the afternoon. I think there's an idea that you've got to try to change that and have eight-hour school days, give kids extracurricular activities ranging from glee clubs to sports and things like that to keep them away from the streets and away from the temptations of the drug gangs. Of course, whether they can deliver on these kinds of things is a different matter, but that's the kind of talk that they're promising.
David Liu now, again, Latin American Bureau Chief for the Wall Street Journal, based in Mexico City. Andres Rosenthal is chair of the Mexican Council for International Affairs, former Deputy Minister of Mexico, senior non-resident fellow at the Brookings Institution. Now, Mr. Rosenthal, good to have you on our program.
Thank you. Good to be with you.
With regard to the violence, which is certainly what attracts the most attention and the most coverage here in this country, partly because this country is responsible for the demand that fuels the drug trade, what options are there to what President Calderon has been doing? And are people as supportive of him as David Liu now suggests?
I think the issue, as David says, is not so much the fact that people disagree with what has been in effect an important part of his administration's policy to hit the drug dealers, the drug cartels, and so on, but rather the strategy that he has employed to do it. And I think that on that there is a fair amount of disappointment and a fair amount of criticism in Mexico. And I think that whoever wins the presidency on the 1st of July is going to have to address the issue of the strategy. Will the new government make this a centerpiece of its domestic and foreign policy, as Calderon has? The U.S.-Mexico relationship, for example, has been securitized almost to 100% degree. Or is he going to do what other countries do when they fight organized crime, and that is get on with the fight against organized crime, but not make it a centerpiece of an administration's public strategy in terms of repeating over and over and over again over the 5.5 years that he's been president, almost 6 years now, that is his number one priority. I think that that's where the issue lies, how the media deal with this, how the government has placed the media at the front of its strategy by putting the people that they've caught, the cartel leaders that they've caught up on television and making a spectacle almost of this. I think that's where the issues are, and I think that's what the new president of Mexico, whoever he or she may be, will have to address.
Do you agree that the candidate of the PRI is, in fact, leading and likely to win, and that we are going to see the return of the PRI?
Well, I don't think it's a question of my agreeing. I think that that's what all of the polls and all of the information that's available indicates, that he has at the worst, a 15% lead, 15 point lead, and at the best, over a 20 point lead over Ms. Vasquez Mota. So, we're only two months and some away from the election. It would seem very, very difficult for that trend to be reversed unless something very, very unusual or unexpected happens.
I understand that Mrs. Vasquez Mota was 4 hours late for her first campaign appearance and spoke to a empty hall or empty stadium. I'm not sure which it was. That can't have done her much good.
It was a stadium, and no, I don't think it does them much good. But to put things in perspective, I think all of the candidates have had scheduling problems. They've all been late at arriving at some of their campaign events. This particular event that you're mentioning had to do, I think, with some issues relating to her transportation and the fact that she doesn't have the same degree of flexibility that, for example, Mr. Peña Nieto has, because the PRI has more money and more ability to use private aircraft and so on. But I think all of the candidates have misstepped in their campaigns, not only on the issue of punctuality, but also Mr. Peña Nieto famously made some rather silly remarks at the Guadalajara Book Fair months ago. Mr. López Obrador has been a wolf in sheep's clothing, trying to show that he is a changed individual, but I don't think very many people believe him, and he's now reverted back to a persecution complex and saying that everything's stacked against him. So it hasn't been a very interesting, and it certainly hasn't been a very challenging campaign in terms of what the Mexican electorate has to look at and eventually decide upon on the 1st of July.
Andres Rosenthal, again, with the Mexican Council for International Affairs, chair of that council, former deputy minister of Mexico, now at the Brookings Institution. John Ackerman is a law professor at the National Autonomous University of Mexico, columnist for various outlets, including London's Guardian. John Ackerman, good to have you on our program.
How you doing, Warren? A pleasure.
Vicente Fox, who was the PAN candidate that first dislodged the PRI 12 years ago and the predecessor of President Calderon, has said that it's time to legalize drugs, certainly marijuana and perhaps cocaine as well, to take the money out of the traffic and deal with the problem of drug trafficking in that way. Is that likely to fly in the Mexican election?
Well, it's interesting, actually, like as David mentioned, that this has not turned into one of the central topics of debate in the campaigns. It's been much more important, for instance, in the Council of America summit with voices coming from Colombia and Guatemala. And this is starting to filter down through in Mexico. Calderon himself has started to change a little bit of his public discourse about this topic to at least being willing to talk about it. And there is a growing amount of public opinion in favor of talking about alternatives. We have to be aware also that actually a consumption and possession of small amounts of illegal drugs is actually legal in Mexico. The Supreme Court has actually recently decided that if you're an addict, you can even have above the amount that's permitted by the law. The next step would be, think about legalizing the transportation of drugs, for instance, to the United States, which this transportation, of course, has absolutely no harm on Mexican society. And if the United States insists on combating those drugs, they would have to do it on their own side of the border. And so I think these kinds of issues are up in the discussion. Calderon himself, in an interview in the New York Times about 6 months ago, talked about market alternatives. So I think that some level of increased legalization or re-regulation of drugs is definitely something that's possible after the elections.
Andres Rosenthal, back to you. After the elections, we're hearing, what are the prospects that it might come up during the election, particularly if there is some particular incident, once again reminding people of the bloody violence that they've been living with for so long?
I'm not sure that people need reminding. Basically, this is something which we all have to live with on a day-to-day basis here. I think that even after the election, a major change in legislation is going to be difficult. What I think is most interesting is that after the Cartagena summit, there is now a basic agreement among the countries of the hemisphere, including the United States and Canada, that it's worthwhile looking back into the issue of how we as a society deal with the issue of drugs and drug consumption. And that as a result of that, we may be able, in a more first regional and then maybe even global scenario, to be able to change some of the parameters under which we're operating. Right now we're operating on parameters of basic prohibition of consumption in most places, as John says, not in Mexico, but in most places, prohibition on trade and sale, the growing, the manufacture, and so on. And I think that basically there has been a shift in public opinion in the United States, not only other countries. You now have sitting presidents like President Santos of Colombia, President Pérez Molina of Guatemala, President Chinchilla of Costa Rica, in addition to former leaders like President Fox and President Cedillo.
I'm going to have to interrupt you. Excuse me. We need to take a break. We'll come right back with To the Point.
Subscribe to the To the Point podcast at kcrw.com or on the podcast page at iTunes. You can also find To the Point on KCRW's smartphone apps, now for iPhone, Android, and BlackBerry.
Warren Olney back with To the Point. Talk today about Mexico's presidential campaign. 3 months long, it will has just begun. It will end on the 1st of July with the election of one of three candidates. President Felipe Calderon can't succeed himself. The issue of drug violence in the campaign, which has been, in Mexico, which has been his number one priority, has apparently not been the number one priority of the three candidates. But we're just hearing from Andres Rosenthal of the Mexican Council for International Affairs, former deputy minister of that country, that there might ultimately, after the election is over, be a reassessment of the way drugs are dealt with both regionally and internationally. And Andres Rosenthal, I apologize for having to interrupt you to go to a break, but let me ask you to finish your point.
Well, I was just saying that I think that there's been a change in attitudes and that you have sitting heads of state now that have decided that something needs to be done and that one needs to study and look back into the issue of how we as a society deal with the question of drug consumption, which in turn would lead to a review of drug production and drug transit and so on. So I think that that has made a big difference. Now, I don't think it is related to the Mexican election in the sense that the decision was taken at Cartagena by all of the heads of state who attended the Summit of the Americas a couple of weeks ago. And it is not, I think, tied in any way to the Mexican election, but they've tasked the OAS Secretary General to begin to work on that review, and we'll see how it goes. But it's obvious to me, and I think to many, that there has been a change in terms of even of public opinion in the United States about the issue of drugs and legalization or decriminalization and other aspects of the question.
Again, the OAS is the Organization of American States. So, John Ackerman, quickly back to you. You mentioned the possibility of legalizing transportation to the United States. You said you didn't think that would be an issue in the campaign necessarily, but to what extent is that being talked about?
It's not being talked about. I think there's going to be a lot of things to be discussed after the elections. I think the elections will be a major turning point. Either one of the three candidates will have to rethink and convene society to think about a different strategy to go forth in this drug war in Mexico, and particularly rethink the relations between the United States and Mexico on the topic. I want to get back to the elections, if you let me, Warren, because there are some things that Andres mentioned which I want to take issue with. He's saying that there's not a lot of excitement here in Mexico during the campaigns. Maybe it's because you're up in Washington. I'm not sure. But down here in Mexico City, there is plenty of excitement. The campaigns have just sort of gotten off. This is began 2.5 weeks ago, right in the middle of actually a vacation. This week is the first week of campaigns, and there was already a public debate between the PAN and the PRI underneath a bridge in the state of Mexico, which had been apparently badly constructed by the PRI candidate, who was the governor of the state of Mexico. There are going to be two debates coming up the first week of May, the first week of June. They're going to be this is the first time that by law all the candidates are forced to debate. The different media outlets have started to talk about inviting the different candidates to the debate. Next week, one of the leading radio announcers has invited all four candidates to debate, and all have accepted except for the front runner, Peña Nieto from the PRI. The polls show that Peña Nieto is way ahead, but there's an interesting number about the polls. Most of the polls have from between a 50 and a 60% no response rate. This says something very powerful, and if we look at the poll results from the last few state-level elections and federal elections, we notice that there's actually a huge discrepancy between what the polls say and what actually happens in the voting box. And this campaign, this race has really just started. It's a three-way race, and I wouldn't call this a show at this early state by any means.
John Ackerman again at the National Autonomous University of Mexico and a columnist for The Guardian, among other outlets. Andres Rosenthal, I believe we reached you in Mexico City. You're not here in the United States, right?
I'm not in the United States. I don't live in the United States. I'm a non-resident fellow at Brookings, and I insist very much that many of the people I speak to, who may be different from the ones that Mr. Ackerman speaks to, are very disillusioned by the tone And I'd say even the quality of the candidates. There is a general feeling that we in Mexico could have a better set of people to run the country. But things being what they are, that's the those are the people we have. Those are the candidates that were chosen by the political parties. And we'll just have to deal with it. I agree on one thing, and that is that there will probably be a fairly high rate of abstention of non-voters because of that disillusionment, because of people think that Peña Nieto has the election in the bag and may not, their vote may not really make that much of a difference.
David Lunau with the the Wall Street Journal. You mentioned the polls too. John Ackerman says there's a 50-60% no response rate. Does that throw them into some doubt?
I don't know if there's a 50 or 60% no response rate. I don't know the answer to that. I do know that there are about 25% of voters who say they are undecided. That's obviously a big pool of voters that could tilt away from the PRI in past elections. As those people have made up their minds, they have tended to tilt away from the PRI. A lot of those in the 2006 election tilted at the last moment toward President Calderon, and that sort of gave him his very narrow margin of victory. But in the broad outlines, I would agree with Mr. Rosenthal. I think there is a generalized lack of enthusiasm, a feeling that the Mexican political system and the three main political parties are kind of letting down the people a little bit. In the case of the leftist party, I think there could have been a lot more enthusiasm had the party picked the current mayor of Mexico City, Marcelo Ebrard, instead of the previous candidate, which they had already picked and who is a very polarizing figure and already had very many negatives among many in the middle class. So I think there's a generalized sense of, gee, you know, none of these guys are great choices. None of the guys and girls, I should say, are great choices. A disillusionment with the parties, and that has to do with just deeper and broader questions about the way Mexico's democracy is working or not.
So, John Ackerman, back to you. You said the campaign is just beginning. Things might well change. Our other guests seem to think that it's much more likely that disillusionment will continue and that perhaps, as Andres Rosenthal put it, there's going to be a very high rate of abstention because everybody thinks that the PRI candidate has it in the bag.
Well, I think this is definitely the impression that's being created in terms of the poll results. I think there is definitely some disillusionment. The thing here is that the leading candidate, Peña Nieto, is such an airhead. No, it's really quite incredible listening to him talk and his announcements and the propaganda on the television. And you know, Rosenthal mentioned this mistake that he committed in the book fair in Guadalajara, which he couldn't name. You know, any book that he had read in the last few years. It's such a weak candidate in terms of his actual proposals and his vision of the country, that it seems like it might be very likely for one of the other candidates to actually poke a hole in that sort of media bubble which has been covering him over the last few years.
Okay, we'll see if Andres Rosenthal is right and the other candidates aren't significantly an improvement. I want to go back to the issue of the drug question, and even though it's not a primary issue in the campaign as yet, it's certainly, as we heard, a fact of life in Mexico. Mark Kleiman is a professor of public policy at UCLA's Luskin School of Public Affairs. His latest book is Drugs and Drug Policy, What Everybody Needs to Know. It'll be published in June. Professor Kleiman, good to have you on our program.
Thanks very much, Warren. That's actually the book that was published last year. Coming in June is marijuana legalization.
Marijuana legalization. Okay.
Right.
Well, that's exactly the question
right.
I wanted to raise because of what happened at Cartagena, where other heads of state indicated that they thought that ought to be considered. Certainly the head of state of the United States isn't going in that direction anytime soon.
Yeah, I think drug legalization is the flat tax or gold standard of drug policies. It's a great bumper sticker. It's a great soundbite. It's a great tweet. Doesn't stand up very well to analysis. And most of the people who are arguing for it are saying, let's have a debate about. But then there's not much to say. I mean, the notion that Mexico could become a through shipment point for cocaine, heroin, and methamphetamine to the U.S., and not have a domestic market in those things seems to be quite fantastic. And Mexico has a growing domestic market. A lot of the violence in Mexico is now not about dealing to the U.S., so that certainly was the major problem in the past, but about competition for drug turf within cities in Mexico. The sad thing is that if we got away from the legalization debate, which is, as you say, something that's not going to happen, there are actual serious policies we could pursue that would greatly reduce the violence. There are ways of reducing the amount of drugs used in the U.S. Most of our drug consumption is a relatively small number of very heavy users who are also criminally active in other ways, which means they're on probation or they're on parole, which means we could stop them from using drugs just by using those systems to enforce drug abstinence. And Judge Stephen Amon in Hawaii and Late Niles in Texas and a couple of other programs, one in California, have demonstrated that if you use frequent testing and swift and certain but mild sanctions, a couple of days in jail for a dirty drug test, you can get 80% of a group of hardcore criminally active drug users to stop, which, among other things, keeps them out of prison, which is good for everybody. But it also deprives the drug markets of their best customers. That's a practical thing that we could be doing now to make life better in Mexico. Debating legalization in Cartagena is just good, clean fun. It's great displacement activity from serious work, but it doesn't get us anywhere.
So do you think that drug legalization, or perhaps the alternative that you're suggesting, much more likely, it seems to me, might be a topic for discussion in the presidential campaign? Or is this to the, such an extent left up to the states? Doesn't seem so when the federal government is cracking down on medical marijuana users in various states that have legalized it.
I don't see any suggestion that this is going to be an issue in the presidential campaign. I hope it's not. Drug policy is not something that makes for good public debate. Again, the interesting stuff is too complicated, and the simple stuff is too wrong. I think there's a reasonable case for legalizing cannabis in some form, and I think we're actually going to see that maybe 10 years from now. The problem is that legalizing marijuana doesn't do anything about the drugs that are really generating the drug market violence. Marijuana is probably 15 or 20% of the revenues of the Mexican drug trafficking organizations. So legalizing marijuana doesn't do much about their wealth or about their violence. If we want to end the drug war, then we've got to legalize everything. And I don't think anybody's ready to legalize methamphetamine.
I know you need to leave in just a minute or so. What is the degree of penetration of Mexican drug cartels into this country, and to how successful have we been in dealing with them?
Their penetration is that they sell wholesale drugs.
But are they here? America. Are they growing marijuana, for example? Are they trafficking? Do they have members of the cartels in this country?
There's lots of discussion about that. As far as I can tell, these are mostly arm's-length transactions. I mean, does General Motors have employees in Peoria to sell cars? No, there are General Motors dealerships in Peoria. It's much closer to that. There was a time when a couple of the Colombian organizations really were vertically integrated and had U.S. distribution networks. That doesn't seem to be true. In Baltimore, there was a big raid on traffickers affiliated with a Sinaloa cartel. And a reporter got to one of the arrestees and asked him how long he'd been working with Sinaloa. And he said, "Sina who?" He was a street drug dealer. He was buying drugs from the guy he knew who would sell him drugs. He didn't know anything about Mexican drug trafficking.
Okay. I want to make good on our commitment and let you go. The hour has arrived. Mark Kleiman, professor at UCLA, thanks a lot for being on our program.
Warren, thanks very much. Always a pleasure.
And John Ackerman, I know you need to leave immediately almost. What's your take on what you heard about what's happening here in the United States? Should the United States take different kinds of actions with regard to drugs?
Sure, I think that there's a lot the United States could do to help bring peace to Mexico. I mean, everything from legalization, which I think is a very important thing to be thinking about, to other kinds of strategies like the professor was mentioning. And I think that Mexico needs to do a whole lot more also on its side of the border to focus on those crimes which affect the Mexican people. And not worry so much about other crimes which are not creating as much violence. The Mexican priority today is to bring about peace. I mean, we're in the middle of a major humanitarian disaster. 60,000 people have died over the last 6 years. We have between 150 and 300,000 displaced people. I mean, this is really a war zone. And something needs to happen to pacify the country and to build institutions. And that's really what relates between Mexico and the United States we need to think about in terms of this year, which is a strategic moment for that, with elections on both sides of the border. And I think it's really time to go beyond Merida. Merida was a Bush plan. Obama hasn't come up with anything new. Neither has Calderon. I think that the new governments on both sides, or the re-election of Obama if that happens, the second government, we'll really have to think about new creative solutions to resolve the major humanitarian crisis which is happening in Mexico.
John Ackerman, law professor at the National Autonomous University of Mexico, columnist for The Guardian and other publications. Thanks a lot for being on our program.
Thank you, Warren.
Let me go back to Andres Rosenthal again, who's chair of the Mexican Council for International Affairs. Why do you suppose, given what we just heard first from you, saying that everybody in Mexico has to live with this horrible violence, and what John Ackerman just said about being in the midst of a humanitarian disaster, why isn't it a major issue in the political campaign?
Well, partly because I don't think he's right. I don't think that we are in the middle of a humanitarian disaster, nor do I think that the use of the label war zone is applicable to the whole country. There are certainly areas of Mexico, especially along the border with the United States, which perhaps could legitimately be called what he said. I live here in Mexico City, and there certainly you could never consider Mexico City to be in that category, nor any of the resorts to which American tourists and tourists from all over the world come. We had a 23% increase in tourism last year, in spite of all these negative media reports about what's happening here. What is true is that we have a serious problem. It is definitely a problem which relates to the consumption in the United States of drugs, but not only in the United States. Civilization has been consuming mind-altering substances almost since the beginning.
So there certainly is a market for illegal drugs in Mexico.
Well, there's a market for illegal drugs in every single country in the world.
Sure.
I don't think there is a country that perhaps with exception of even in Malaysia and in Singapore where you can get the death penalty for dealing in drugs, there is a market for them. So, I mean, this is not exclusive to Mexico. And I think that it really doesn't make any sense to look at it from the point of view of one country being at the forefront of the issue. Colombia was in that unfortunate position some years ago. Today, Colombia has a different image, even though Colombia still produces the same, pretty much the same amount of cocaine that it has produced for the last 30 or 40 years and exports it to the United States. Now it exports it through Mexico rather than exporting it through the Caribbean, which is where it used to go before. But to come back to something that David said, and I think I would sort of end on that. This issue is on the minds of Mexicans during the election campaign. The candidates have not yet focused on it. I think they will have to focus on it when the debates start and when the interaction with public opinion becomes more heated and more intense between now and the 1st of July. And I don't think it's going to be easy for any of the three candidates to sort of sidestep the issue because it is a very important issue. And it affects our relationship with the United States, and it affects our relationship with other countries as well.
I hope you will come back and talk to us as the campaign develops. Andres Rosenthal, again, chair of the Mexican Council for International Affairs, former deputy minister of Mexico, senior non-resident fellow at the Brookings Institution. Thanks very much for being on our program today. And David Lunau, Latin American bureau chief of the Wall Street Journal, thanks to you as well for being on our program. Hopefully you can come back and join us again as well. Secret service agents with prostitutes in Colombia, bureaucrats partying in Las Vegas, juicy scandals are interfering with the president's campaign messages. More in a moment on To the Point.
Share your comments about today's show at kcrw.com/to the point or join the conversation on our Facebook page. You can also follow us on Twitter at @to the point_KCRW.
Norman Olney back with Reporter's Notebook on To The Point. While the president talks about oil market manipulation and international relations, he gets his stories published. But the media really have been focusing more, I think, on misbehavior by the Secret Service, hiring prostitutes in Colombia, and the partying by the bureaucrats at great expense from the General Services Administration in Las Vegas. Michelle Cottle is Washington correspondent for Newsweek and The Daily Beast, and good to have you on our program.
Well, it's great to be here.
You have written about how these sleazy scandals have been taken up, as you would expect they would, politics being what it is, by the Republicans.
Well, absolutely. I mean, what you want from a good scandal to take, you know, to get a little traction is it needs to have a little zip, a little sex appeal. And this is the first one during the Obama administration that they've kind of stumbled across that fits the bill.
Well, they didn't stumble across it. It's gotten a whole lot of publicity. Certainly the GSA hiring the mind readers and the clowns. We've seen pictures of clowns all over television.
Yes. The only people who like a good sexy scandal more than the Republicans, that would be the media. We just can't resist it. It's just so much fun to write about.
And the Democrats love it when the Republicans are in power.
Oh, absolutely. It's the political opposition. It's not just the Republicans.
So what are we hearing from the Republicans and from those news outlets, conservative talk radio, Fox News, and so on, about all this? How are they using it?
Well, you can't tie this directly to Obama. This is not like some of the scandals we've seen in the past, you know, the Clinton year type scandals. But what you can do is it plays well with that whole Republican message that government is out of control. You know, this is big government run amok. And it plays into the idea that Obama can't control the government. He's not equipped to run the country. So both of these points are being made pretty much across the board. And you know, you'll probably have them come up again in the election farther down the road.
Back to the issue of whether he's equipped or not, certainly the Secret Service is close to the president, quite literally, although the agents involved in this scandal, as I understand it, even though they were in Colombia at the same time the president was, they weren't directly part of his immediate personal guard.
No, there is a distinction here. Before the president goes anywhere, they send out an advance team, and the advance team checks things. They make sure nobody's going to blow up anything, that all the routes are secure. And these guys were with the advance team. They were not part of the presidential detail of the Secret Service.
Not a distinction, though, that's made very much by the Republicans.
Well, it's nice to blur those lines. I mean, likewise, the GSA Regional Western Conference and some, you know, genius bureaucrat who thought it would be a great idea to rent some clowns and mind readers isn't really, it's far enough down the food chain that the president, no way he would have known about this. And we are talking about an agency that has a fine record of overspending throughout the Bush years as well. But that said, it happens on his watch. He's going to get smacked with it.
Here's Jeff Sessions, a Republican senator from Alabama. Presidents are to be held responsible. They also need to be responsible for insisting that from the top to the lowest employee, not one single dollar will be wasted in government. I don't sense this president has shown that kind of managerial leadership. Has any president ever shown that kind of managerial leadership?
Getting down in the muckety-muck with the GSA. I mean, they have put in people to kind of work on tightening the reins and stuff. But you are talking about a bureaucratic culture, and everyone seems to agree that the GSA has long-standing problems. That said, those finer points are not what makes good sound bites. What you need to just get in there, the government anger at the moment, or the anti-government sentiment of the moment, fits really neatly with the idea that while the rest of America is tightening its belts, you have these crazy bureaucrats, you know, living it up in Vegas on your tax dollar. So I think this is going to be the one that's going to give the White House the bigger heartburn. I mean, the Secret Service with the Colombian prostitutes has great potential for a story, but I don't think it's going to have quite the legs as the GSA issue.
Even though it has sex?
Oh, it's extremely sexy. But, you know, you're in Vegas. Vegas is sexy. Come on now. It's not like they were partying it up in Wichita. No, there's anything wrong with Wichita.
What about the awful pictures that we saw in the Los Angeles Times have gone worldwide of American soldiers posing with the body parts of dead Afghan insurgents? Is that something that has been used against the administration, or is that a little too delicate to be made all that political?
It's a much touchier subject. I mean, people are, of course, going to take any opportunity to criticize. But with something like this, you don't want to kind of get out there with the same gusto, because there are questions about what the repercussions will be overseas. Will it make us a target? Will it put people in danger? And, you know, the administration did argue against these pictures being put out there. I mean, there were much discussions with the LA Times editors and things like that. So that's a much trickier issue, and it doesn't play quite as much into the kind of the bloated government stereotype. I mean, everybody wants a strong military. And so while this is, you know, a little bit icky and could raise some questions about the control issues, it's not nearly as tailor-made as the other stuff.
Back to the other issues, does the fact that you mentioned the distinction between this president and, for example, President Clinton when it comes to personal behavior, Barack Obama and the family have turned out to be picture perfect, haven't they?
Yes, and I think in this way, he's lucky, especially with the Secret Service scandal. I mean, talking to some historians and academics and political science types, they note that if this had been Bill Clinton, not only would you have had the kind of government run amok criticisms, you would have had the argument that he set the tone for this. You know, much like Kennedy in the 60s with the Secret Service partying it up, I mean, you would have had just kind of a real parallel drawn. You know, see, he's a sleazy president, and he's got a sleazy, you know, partying Secret Service going on. But you don't have that with Obama, okay, because he is picture-perfect in that regard.
Michelle Cottle, again, Washington correspondent for Newsweek and the Daily Beast. Thanks a lot for being on our program.
It's my pleasure.
Our producers of To the Point are Francis Anderton, Christian Bordahl, Katie Cooper, Anna Scott, and Caitlin Schamberg. Our technical director is Mike Newport. Managing producer, Sonia Geis. Thanks also to the John Coltrane family. I'm Warren Olney. Join us again for To the Point. Produced live and podcast as a co-production of KCRW Santa Monica and Public Radio International.
PRI, Public Radio International.